Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Dermot MacDonald with you this weekend. Well, our newspaper panel have been busy this morning selecting the best and the rest for you from today's papers, and I'll introduce you to them shortly. But first, as always, let's have a quick look at what is making the headlines. Several of the broadsheets lead in some shape or form with the ongoing fallout from the controversy at Children's Health Ireland and the expose on the standards of care in two private nursing homes by RTE Investigates. Consultants face HSE inquiry over cash payments. That's the lead in the Sunday Times, which first broke the story about the contents of an internal 2021 CHI report that led to a formal meeting last Friday between senior HSE officials and Gardaí to discuss the potential misappropriation of public funds. The Irish Mail on Sunday leads with a story from a whistleblower who has reported concerns about alleged abuses of the National Treatment Purchase Fund to the paper. Former Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Holohan is pictured following his wedding yesterday to mindfulness-based psychotherapist Claire Cronin, and that is on the front page of the Sunday Independent. But it is RTE that provides the lead for the paper with a report that sports presenter Des Cahill is at the centre of a landmark €11 million court case. Ahead of this week's decision by the Cabinet to review rules around market caps on rents, the Business Post leads with an industry warning that a two-tier rental market won't deliver homes. And you could paper a room, if not a large granny flat, with the amount of coverage on rent pressure zones in the papers today. Many, in fact, all of the papers cover the moving funeral yesterday in Kenmare of murdered sheep farmer Michael Gain. Farewell to generous, kind Michael. That's the lead story for the Irish Sunday Mirror. We are taking back Mike's dignity. That's a splash for the Irish Sun on Sunday, which captures many of the tributes to Mr. Gain described as the glue that held his family together. The House of Player is the lead for the Sunday World, which pictures Christina Gallagher, founder of the controversial House of Prayer on Achill Island, playing slot machines in a Dublin casino last week on a win and a prayer, is the headline inside the paper. Across the Irish Sea, the seemingly never-ending culture wars continue. 2 days after Reform UK party chairman Zia Yusuf resigned and then reinstated himself as chairman less than 48 hours later, in a row over the party's stance on banning burqas. The Sunday Telegraph reports that Tory leader Kemi Badenoch has said that bosses should have the right to ban staff from wearing burqas and other face coverings in the workplace. 2 days after his retirement and now reinstatement, Mr. Yusuf said he's going to concentrate his efforts on running what he describes as the UK Doge team. It'll be interesting to see how that comes about. But listen, we have a great panel for you this morning. Louise Byrne, political correspondent for the Irish Mirror. Sarah Carey, columnist for the Irish Independent. Professor Ronan Collins, consultant geriatrician. And Sam Tranum, editor of the Dublin Inquirer. But before I get to chat to all of them, I want to start today with the incredible Senior Hurling Championship final, which saw Cork break Limerick's streak in the Gaelic grounds yesterday. Let's speak to RTE's Gaelic Games correspondent Marty Morrissey. Marty, this wasn't just a dramatic showdown. It was historic as well. The game ending in a penalty shootout in hurling.
Yeah, it was amazing, Derval. I mean, it was one of the great days, I think, of Munster hurling finals. Yeah. And it has a rich, rich history going way, way back. And certainly, you know, when you think of the Christy Rings and Mick Mackeys and Jimmy Barry Murphy's, Eamon Grimes, that have all, with hundreds, possibly thousands of other players that played in Munster Championship hurling games, Munster hurling finals, there was nothing quite like yesterday, I felt. It was the very first time a Munster hurling final was played on a Saturday evening. We will never forget it. It's the first time a Munster hurling final went to penalties. We won't forget that either. And I'll be honest, dramatic from our point of view, from viewers, but I just think it's very, very tough on the players to lose a Munster Championship final after all of that on penalties. And whether it was Cork or Limerick, my heart would go out to them. But for Cork, it was a historic occasion because Limerick were going for 7 Munster championships in a row. This Limerick team are magnificent. And John Kiely, I think it was his 15th final in nine years being in charge. And last night was the first time that he lost a final, which is truly 14 finals up to now, 14 victories. And the good thing is, Derval, that although Limerick were beaten by the penalty shootout, they are still in the championship. And I have that feeling that Limerick will have a major save in the All-Ireland before the year is over.
Yeah, I didn't know what had happened. I didn't get a chance to see it, but the notifications on my phone just blew up. It was just incredible then to get reading about it. I know it is onwards to Croke Park for you today, Marty, for the Leinster hurling final between Kilkenny and Galway. So I better let you get on your way. Thanks for joining us this morning. And just to remind you that listeners can hear Marty with Brian Carroll at 4 o'clock here today on Radio 1. But before that, you can catch the Joe McDonagh final between Kildare and Laois, which starts at 2 p.m. on Sunday Sport, also here on RTE Radio 1. Professor Ronan Collins, as a Cork man, you didn't so much walk in here today as float.
Well, absolutely. But I suppose when one reflects on it, one thinks of what a national treasure hurling is, really. And I'm sure we will see an equally courageous, titanic battle today inside in Croke Park. But yeah, yesterday's match was extraordinary. The scenes afterwards were extraordinary. It is an unfortunate way to watch a match end. Even because the penalties were actually sent wide, they weren't even saved as such. I'm not sure that's the way to end the match. You know, Limerick have been an absolutely amazing hurling team, probably the best hurling team I've seen in my generation, apart from maybe the Cork 3-in-a-row team in the 70s. Of course, I'd be biased, or the Kilkenny 4-in-a-row team. There's been several ones, but Limerick have been outstanding. But what a titanic struggle. And the scenes afterwards from a Cork perspective on the pitch, just the adulation, the joy amongst the young Cork supporters. It was just a fantastic occasion. And, you know, I do sympathise with Limerick. It was a tough match to lose.
You're still secretly so well.
I secretly, of course, I'm delighted and will definitely take it. But, you know, I think both teams, I think most people would say the match was a draw.
Yeah. Were you glad to see the penalties, or would you prefer to see the replay? It's hard yards.
It's hard yards because these are amateur players, and you know, this takes its physical toll, and you have to go back and do a match again. Louise is nodding here next to me. Louise is a real Leinster girl. She said to me, on the way in today, when we were discussing the match first, she said, "What match?"
Huge congrats to the Leinster rugby team on their semi-final win yesterday. Looking forward to the final next week in Croke Park. Congrats to Cork as well, I suppose.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, listen, we will move on to other matters. And Louise, Gabia Gadavkaitse in the Sunday Independent has the briefest but possibly the most informative report in the papers today on the rent pressure zones ahead of this critical meeting of the Cabinet early next week.
Yeah, and there's been quite a lot written about this in today's papers, but I certainly think Gabia seems to have the greatest level of detail. So this has been a discussion that's been going on really since the formation of this government back in January, when Taoiseach Micheál Martin came out and said that the rent pressure zones would be reviewed. And I think what you saw at that point was instant pushback from the opposition, saying that there would be uproar if these would be removed. Because what the rent pressure zones do is that they limit the amount that rent can be increased to either 2% or the level of inflation, whichever is lowest. So it's usually in around 2%. And you saw at the start of that Fine Gael as well, kind of very much distancing themselves from any idea that the rent pressure zones will be changed. So the discussion has been ongoing on this for weeks. My understanding is it will be discussed at a leaders level but it will be again tomorrow evening before a cabinet decision is made on Tuesday, and this is going to be highly controversial no matter what happens.
Whatever decision is made,
this is it, and I mean, this is going to create trouble either way for the government. It would appear very close to the summer recess, so I think this really is going to dominate the next couple of weeks. But what Gabia Gadavkaitse is reporting in the Sunday Independent today is that there will be rent caps kept in place for existing dwellings. So if you are in an older apartment or a home and you're renting, then your rent cap will be kept at that 2%. They're also going to look at, Gabia says, limiting evictions during the first 6 years of a tenancy, and during that the 2% will remain. However, sources said that no fault evictions may be restricted for the first 6 years of a tenancy, which is kind of a new departure for the government, and it'd be interesting to see how the opposition reacts to that. What Gabia is also also saying is that landlords will be able to reset rent after 6 years to market rates under the plans. I think there's a few questions still to be asked about that. Is that after a tenant moves out? Is that if an existing tenancy is remaining in place? Also, and this again was first reported by the Business Post actually on Friday evening, this idea that the rent caps won't apply to new build apartments. And this, I suppose, is part of a government push to incentivise private apartment building, which they say has fallen off a cliff. Now, I think it's interesting because you can see it. I think specifically in Dublin, you can see all these new build apartments going up, and they are so expensive to rent. If you look them up, they're all built to rent, which
they're a lot of mortgages.
Yeah, and I mean, and people I would assume would like to take mortgages out on these apartments, but and oftentimes the tenure is wrong and they're all built to rent, so they can't be bought. So what is being reported, like I said, by the Business Post originally on Friday evening, is that this rent cap won't apply to the new build apartments. So creating this two-tier rental system, and I think it'd be interesting to see if this is what is agreed by Cabinet on Tuesday. But secondly, not only just the opposition reaction, but the market reaction and the reaction to tenants who are no doubt looking at this with a great feeling of trepidation.
Sam Tronham and the Dublin Inquirer has done a lot of work on rent pressure zones and really sort of getting in under the bonnet of the issues. Are the government damned if they do and damned if they don't? Because they're in sort of a pressure zone of their own in terms of tenants on the one hand, but the market on the other, and investors, and this need to deliver homes.
I think the government are damned if they do and damned if they don't. The current rent pressure zones are not very effective, as you can see by the increasing rents year after year. That is beyond 2% every report. There's lots of ways around them, from saying you're keeping the rent the same but adding hundreds of euros of fees on top for made up things, to putting people on licenses instead of on tenancies. That said, they do restrain rent increases to some extent, so getting rid of them altogether would just result in more expensive housing. The provision where you can reset to market rents if you get the tenant out is obviously creating an incentive to evict people or to push people out, you know, in other ways.
I need that property back. I need all of that.
I'm going to do a major renovation. Now you need to get out, kind of thing. So that's not going to be good. And fundamentally, none of this is going to get housing built at the affordable lower end of the rental market, which is where it's more needed, because people who fall out of that fall into homelessness. And people at the lower end are spending a larger proportion of their salaries on rent than people at the higher end. Like, the way to do that, like, is clearly to build more social housing and to get the LDA to build more cost rental housing, and fiddling around the edges of the RPZs is not going to fix it.
Yeah. Sarah Carey, you picked out a piece, I think, in the Business Post, Mary Conway, time to stop ignoring small landlords and discard the rent cap. Do you agree?
So the rent cap causes huge problems. And I know there's often a narrative that, you know, the dole is filled with landlords and, you know, they're biasing policies in favour of landlords. When, say, for instance, Marion Finnegan from Sherry Fitzgerald, who's quoted on the front page of the Sunday Business Post, has been pointing out for years that all the policies we have enacted to protect tenants have actually resulted in a flight from the market, both by what they call your mom and pop, your once-off kind of private landlord who compromises 80% of landlords, and the institutional investors.
Dispute the idea that landlords are fleeing the market. CSO data says otherwise. Reducing is registered tenancies.
Okay. Lucinda Creighton, for example, above Mary Conway in the Sunday Business Post, is giving examples from all around the world and for decades, which shows that every time you bring in rent caps, you distort the market. So, for example, in Germany, they brought in rent caps in Berlin in 2020, and it just doesn't work.
How do you protect tenants?
So Mary Conway's piece is pointing out, for example, that you can have one-off landlords who might end up keeping a house empty rather than getting trapped. Tenants get trapped because they're afraid to leave their tenancy and afraid to move in case they lose their tenancy. But here's the big piece, and here's the big picture of all of this, Derval. So I chaired that Property Industry Ireland conference there a couple of weeks ago that made a lot of headlines, and they've calculated...
Because Graham Doyle, the Secretary General of the Department, offered the view that perhaps we didn't need a dedicated housing
czar. Yeah, and I felt a bit bad.
Or that it just needed a different name.
What he later clarified that he wasn't opposed to the role itself, but that he was opposed to the name.
Okay, yeah. So I was there. And the bottom line is that they figured out, KPMG did a study, that we would need about 170 billion to fund the 300,000 units that we're going to need by 2030. At best, the government could pay about 40 to 50 billion of that. The rest has to come from institutional investors. They are avoiding Ireland at the moment for two reasons. Number one, when they try to build developments, they get caught up in this indefinite planning hell and judicial reviews and all of that, or the risk of that, even
Thousands of unbuilt units that they have not built that.
And furthermore, because
this is just the property industry fighting their corner and trying to get higher profits.
So as I said, 170 billion, the money has to come from somewhere. We are depending on institutional investors. And I'm old enough to remember when people kept saying, why can't we be like Germany and other European countries where you have pension funds investing in long-term rental properties so that people would have security of tenure. We are driving out that investment by the rental caps. And I said to one of the panelists on the day, wait, I'm not finished. Where is the money going? And it's going to
Spain.
I would say
we're driving out investors by this constant changing of the rules, by this uncertainty. If we had the rent caps in and everybody knew they were going to be in and it was a long-term strategy that people would stand by, then investment funds would know what the story was.
Investment funds, they
would know how to plan.
Investment funds do know, and they've left the market. That's what's happened.
Or are they building apartments that no one can afford? That's the other issue. Look at all the amount of apartments that we know are vacant in Dublin City because people can't afford them. Like, I was in a local beauty salon the other day and I heard someone talking to their beauty therapist about a load of apartments that have been built locally to us recently. For a one bed, it's 2,200 a month. Mm. Who can afford that for a one bed apartment?
Yeah, and this is where the LDA actually is really important and I do think is going to be a game changer. So this is the Land Development Agency, and they're tasked with building on public land. But just so everybody is clear, Emer O'Callaghan from the LDA was doing a presentation at the Irish Planning Institute conference recently, and she was explaining the cost of converting those brownfield sites in the urban centres into housing. It's unbelievably expensive. Like, a lot of them have to be decontaminated. So you do have a genuine economic problem where the cost of building apartments in those urban zones is prohibitive. And this is why then the other, say, building companies, did the developers, like the Glenveys, like the Castlethorns, are saying the only product that they can afford to develop, that people can afford to buy, is the three-bed semi-D on the outskirts of the town.
And I think the Sunday Independent has done a big, your top 20 developers who are going to get us out of the malaise. Can I ask you, Ronan, there is a lot of coverage in the rent pressure zones, but very, very little actually on the voice of the tenant.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, actually. I think there's a perfect storm in terms of population growth, in terms of inflation, both in the materials involved in building, a shortage in the workforce for building, and then all the factors Sarah mentioned in terms of our planning laws, etc. And, you know, we have a genuine shortage of housing, notwithstanding. I do agree with Louise that there's a lot of vacant dwellings and a lot of places maybe that are too expensive to rent. I was struck by reading all the various articles, though. You get the layout of the political landscape behind this. I think Sarah alludes to the funding model. If you're going down the funding model that we need to build more apartments, then you have to give certainty to an investment fund. An investment fund is not an emotional thing. You know, whether it's fresh frozen orange juice or gold commodities, the care of older people, as we saw during the week.
It's all related.
But you have to deliver the bottom line, or else the investment fund goes somewhere else. So if that's the model which we're building, I'm not saying that's
right. Why are we building with that model? There was a column in as well by Connor Skeen saying we should not be commoditizing housing.
I'm not defending it.
I'm just jumping in to support you.
I'm just saying, but what I did want to come back and just say is that I also am a great believer of my own practice. Evidence must drive the policy. And so we've, I think Wayne O'Connor writing one of the papers point out that HAP may be contributing to it, which is interesting. I wouldn't have considered that, but it might be contributing to inflation. And then you're Lucinda Creighton also writing about, for example, the previous experiences of rent caps and what has done in other countries, and that it's restricted people's mobility. And I suppose that brings me to a point I did want to make. If people are in restricted mobility and can't right-size their accommodation when it's needed, but what's going to happen when all these people get older? Who's going to be paying these rents if they don't own these properties? What's going to happen
Sam,
here?
Sam, you want to come in there. I think you mentioned Conor Skeen's piece in the Sunday Independent. He said it's the headline is, it's a myth that more homes means lower prices. It isn't true, Sam.
I think that's essentially right. Like, if you're if you're going to leave it to the private market to build housing, they're going to try to make as much profit off of it as they can. That's their job. That's what they should be doing. That's what they are doing.
And that's their duty to their shareholders.
That's their duty to their shareholders. And so as long as housing is an investment for big investment funds or, you know, a profit-making enterprise, then it's going to be more expensive than it needs to be. And in his article, Connor Skeehan argues for a complete rethinking and rebalancing of tax incentives for owner-occupiers versus housing investors to encourage people to look at housing as shelter and a service and not as an investment. And I think it's that level of fundamental change that's needed to...
So how would you change. Do that? Well, like, what's the nuts and bolts of that?
I can get you the article out, but...
I've read the article. He doesn't give nuts and bolts.
The one main thing that that I took from that in terms of nuts and bolts was rebalancing the tax incentives between owner-occupiers versus investors in housing.
So the $170 billion that we need to build those houses, mm-hmm. who do you think should pay for that?
I think that the government currently has more billions than it knows what to do with and could invest some in that. I think that it can borrow a lot more. It's always claimed that it can't because of...
We're one of the most heavily borrowed countries in the Eurozone already.
Well, do you know what? I feel like it would be a really good investment, even if it's... requires borrowing more than we would nationally have affordable housing so that people aren't being homeless, so that companies can hire people in Dublin where it's too expensive. So that people will have more disposable income to spend on all the businesses that say they're struggling because they don't have enough customers.
And it is a lot, obviously, the need for social and affordable housing stock. But how do you think, when people are listening to this, that the public are reading, you know, these interventions by the government? You know, when you're talking about a two-tier system potentially going in, like, I mean, is it giving confidence or will it give confidence? As again, they're sort of caught between this tenant and investment, this sort of the big tension, I suppose, playing out.
I think that's the big issue here, is that renters don't feel secure in their tenure. And I mean, that has been the ongoing issue, because if you look at countries across the European Union, there's people that rent for life. There's people, and that is just the way of living in those countries. And there's not the same, I suppose, fascination as there is here with buying a home. And some people will have to rent forever. And I mean, that is just a grim fact of reality, because if you look at the cost of houses at the moment, they are rising and rising and rising. The government is not hitting its housing targets. Yeah. A lot of those housing targets are funded by the private construction companies that we've been speaking about. And I think there's an acceptance that there is going to have to be private money put into housing. But the government is not hitting its own social and affordable housing targets, which it's not going to solve the problem, but it's going to alleviate some of the issues.
And it's your generation, I think, that are most impacted by this. Look, I mean, as I say, the voice of the tenant or the renter seems to be quite quiet in a lot of the coverage. But there was a piece by a young model.
By Thalia Heffernan. Yeah, and I was watching Thalia. She actually made a TikTok on this during the week, and she was speaking to, I think it was Niamh Horan in the Sunday Independent today. But Thalia Heffernan, people might know her, she was on Dancing with the Stars. She was a model. She was living in the US and she came home and she basically had to find a new place to live, and she was saying, you know, this is going to be easy enough, it'll be fine. And she quickly found out that it wasn't fine. She had two dogs, so she was kind of in a situation where she couldn't move home to her family. And she at one point sincerely thought she was going to be homeless because she couldn't find a place to live. And on her TikTok, and indeed in that interview with Niamh Horan today, she was speaking about the mental toll that takes. And I know on TikTok she was kind of saying, you know, you may or may not have noticed, but I haven't been active on here because this is having a real impact on me. And that is a very serious concern that I think specifically renters have, that if they are told they need to move out by their landlord, where are they going to go? Are they going to be able to afford somewhere else to go? It's a real issue.
Sarah Carey, one of the other very salient points that she made, she was like, well, at least if you are living in New York, which is obviously an expensive place to live, your rent is relative to your income. And the point she was making was this is not the case in Ireland.
Actually,
and that is very challenging for particularly young people in their 20s and 30s.
She was also saying there's more supply as well, which is interesting.
And actually that's one of the really good things that we've made progress on, is we've introduced the cost rental system now, and this is the model that the LDA is bringing in. So with social housing, the model used to be that, you know, you went into, say, a council house and your income or your rent was based on your income at that time. You could probably end up staying there indefinitely. In the bid
it's reassessed.
In the bid to try to make housing affordable for the public to invest in. The LDA model is that the rents will be based on the cost of actually building it. And this is actually really important. They call it the Vienna model. And it's really, really worked in Vienna, where that kind of social long-term tenancy that Louise is talking about. One other little thing, though, I think we need to keep in mind is one of the reasons that we've struggled to deliver housing is water and energy, the basic infrastructure. So this infrastructure unit that's going to be set up by Jack Chambers in the department is really important. And Ishke Aaron is pointing out, like, it needs 3.7 billion urgently, because Dublin is going to run out of water in 3 years. Like, it really, really is. So this is more billions that we need to spend. And that's why I think actually not keeping with the water rates model was a terrible problem for Irish Water, because they needed an independent multi-annual funding model that they could invest in this without being dependent year on year on funds from the department. And that's the real emergency now, actually,
Sam,
is water.
That whole point about infrastructure, the wider, yeah, it's about getting electric points in. It's about there's no point in building if we don't have the services.
So what do we think about all the data centres that are sucking up electricity and water? Well, we can't build houses because we can't get electricity and water connections.
Yeah, we have an energy crisis in this country. And here's an interesting thing, Derval. When somebody like Airgrid and ESB Networks are trying to build the infrastructure that we need to get extra energy, what happens, just like Ishke Aaron, when they apply for a wastewater treatment system, just like when you try to develop housing, objections, objections, objections. People are going to have to start realising that if, as an individual, you object to a power line, you object to a wastewater treatment plant, you object to a housing development, this is what delays the delivery of all of this.
What's the solution? Compulsory purchase orders?
So, actually, Airgrid does have the power in the constitution to CPO land, but they don't like to do it because they don't want to get into these conflicted situations with landowners. But but at that PII conference, there was a really strong consensus that some of these big infrastructure issues are going to require exemptions, because otherwise we're running out of energy, we're running out of water.
Well, we're running out of time for my ad break, so I'm going to take a very, very quick one there. We'll be back with you shortly. You're all very welcome. Back with me are Louise Byrne, Sarah Carey, Professor Ronan Collins and Sam Tranum. Let's move to nursing homes. Ronan, it was really interesting that there's so much coverage again, but the voice of someone who has experienced being in a nursing home and receiving respite care forms an opinion piece in the Sunday Independent. Margaret Kennedy's piece struck you.
Yeah, an excellent piece by Margaret. What also struck me, it was an excellent piece by Margaret. I think she lays out many of the dilemmas facing older people, and indeed that will face us all, I hasten to add. Your chances of needing nursing home care going forward in life are about 1 in 3. So it's in all our interest that we have this discussion and that we get this right. It's way beyond time that we got this right. And while I would very much add that what we witnessed during the week from the excellent piece of journalism by Aoife Hegarty and the team was shocking, I don't think it applies to the vast majority of nursing homes. But the fact that it occurred in any nursing home is unacceptable.
And the fact that it took journalists with, you know, the assistance of a whistleblower rather than the regulatory bodies to discover it.
Well, the one thing I've learned about regulation in Ireland, unfortunately, is that regulation makes the compliant more compliant. And it very rarely catches the rogue artist. And if we go back to the property issue, I had a friend one time who was renting a house and told me that the tenants board were taking him to task over this thing about maybe centimetres difference between the windowsill and the pavement, something he had no control over. And he was really being put through the mill by this. And the following week, there was an expose in RTE of people cramming 12 people into a room up in Gardiner Street. I mean, and you just go like, and you know what, I noticed it even in my own simple life. I do fishing for a hobby, right? I might often get inspected by the inland fisheries officers who do a great job, but they won't be inspecting the guy across the river in the white transit van drinking Dutch gold by the river and poaching shamelessly. So we have a problem in regulation in Ireland. I think that regulation, number one, tends to pick the easy targets. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I think regulation is very poorly informed. It's not related enough to the expertise that's involved in nursing homes. And so, for example, if you go back to HICWA, HICWA are probably doing their job. They're probably regulating and inspecting what they're being told to be regulated. But we actually have no agreed, for example, staffing levels, the hours per resident per day. It's not It's not agreed anywhere. It's not underpinned by legislation anywhere. And when you have such a gap in something as fundamental as that, is it any wonder that you then have poor care?
Is it any wonder, Sam, when you look, what is it, 80% of the, you know, the provision, you know, now of nursing home care is by the private sector. But I think what a lot of, and it's not totally divorced from our earlier conversation, I think what we saw a lot in the RT Investigates was capacity and resources, again, playing a big role, or the lack of it.
Yes, I imagine, like, if you're a private company running any kind of business and you want to maximize your profits, obviously one of the ways to do that is to reduce your staffing levels to as low as you can. And wouldn't surprise me if all the private nursing homes are doing that. Like, it's not necessarily the case that public provision is going to be
great. Certainly not all of them. As Rose said, this is not representative of the standards of care right across the country.
If there's no agreed level of staffing, why would they make it as high as possible?
I think there's a lot, I have to interject, though, there's a lot of really well-run smaller Irish companies and family-owned nursing homes that really, I know, I was touched also, you know, it was hard to be part of that
documentary.
Because
they want to care for their patients.
Exactly, and I was touched also by some of the you know, the follow-up commentary on Liveline of people who've devoted their lives to care of older people. And so it's not true to say that's widespread, but I go back to my comment. The fact that it happened in any nursing home to a group of vulnerable people is unacceptable.
Sarah, it will
it
do
does
little. Sorry,
a
Sarah.
Need for better regulation. You were pointing to some of the problems with that. Like, can you talk some more about solutions to improve regulation?
Of course.
To avoid
so,
this?
I mean, the Irish Society of Physicians in Geriatric Medicine produced a very good position paper in the Irish Medical Journal responding to the needs of older residents in residential care. And it set out a framework, and this was after, number one, our experience during COVID, and also after Des O'Neill's report into Leeds Cross back in 2006. And many of those recommendations still hadn't happened. So we need to deal, first of all, with the model. Who decides the model? Do we really want large congregational units, or do we want smaller units with levels of escalation of care nestled within communities so people can really age?
And it's a big issue because of the rapidly growing ageing population.
But Sarah, just to finish the point, secondly, then you need to have the governance right, both in terms of nursing and the medical governance of nursing home needs to be right. There needs to be training and education for the staff, but also, and I'm very passionate about this, if you want our best people to work looking after our frail or older people, you have to, number one, provide people with training and education, but also proper paying conditions and also career progression.
Sarah,
we must develop talent here.
Sarah Kerr, it's 20 years after Leeds Cross, and you know what this RT Investigates, albeit restricted to two homes, it'll do little to assuage the fears of older people, and perhaps, you know, it's, you know, one in three, like, you know, all of us could be potentially looking at, you know, some form of care. So,
If anybody has a relative in any nursing home, obviously they're going to be worried. The population of over 80s is going to double by 2040. So this is a huge issue. And how are we going to manage this and care for people?
Allow the property world leave it to the market? Or is this one of these?
Well, it's funny. I contacted somebody in the Department of Health about this during the week, you know, because obviously the fear was, well, maybe we're leaving again too much of this to the private sector. And they were telling me that the investment in public sector nursing home beds of recent years has been replacing older public sector beds that were condemned by HICWA. You know, so HICWA was going around the state homes and finding problems with them. So all the upgrading that has been done is consuming money at the moment. So obviously you'd hope as time will go on, there will be more public sector beds. But the big issue is, you know, how can we keep older people healthy, keep them in their own homes for as long as possible? My sister actually works for Healthy Ageing Homes Ireland, and that's a new scheme, relatively new scheme, where they go around and into people's homes and they try to provide them with the services and the infrastructure that they'll need to stay in their own home.
Solutions.
Yeah. But funny enough now, both Brenda Power and David Quinn in their columns today, they linked it. And because I think what Brenda said was, you know, it was interesting that the Housewife of the Year documentary was on just 2 days before the nursing home documentary was on. And both of them were linking the two issues for something that has always struck me, which is that when women went out to work, they used to take care of the old and they used to take care of the young. And no government, none, has been able to square that economic circle since. How do you fund the unpaid work that women used to do?
And pay them might be an option.
Yeah, but again, we're back to, so, you know, the 170 billion for the housing, the billions Irish Water needs, the billions and billions this is going to need to care for our older people. There's just infinite money needed for everything. And like, if
only
you,
those women would just go back and stay and do all the intergenerational work, and they've stopped having children.
I have to interject too, Sarah, and make the point that most older people actually are net contributors to the economy.
Yes.
Number one, many older people are still working, running their own businesses, and actually many people are forced to retire when they don't.
No, but it's a very
important point as well, because people talk about this time bomb of demography, which is awful language, because it is a challenge, but it's also a huge human success that we have longevity. And we need to give meaning and actual real purpose to people's lives as they get older. And for example, many older people are looking after our children and driving them to and from school and looking after even for their own adult children.
Louise Byrne, you're nodding your head in agreement there.
I think that's why, like, I think you're right. I think we often, we talk about the pension time bomb, we talk about the care time bomb, and, you know, what are we going to do, and all these
Why aren't enough of you having babies?
Well, that's the other issue as well, because we can't afford houses, but c'est la vie. But I mean, these people have given their lives, and they have paid their taxes, and they deserve good care. And I mean, I think it comes if you read Margaret Kennedy's piece in the Sunday Independent, I think it's actually very moving, and I think everyone should read it. But she was talking about, she feels that older disabled or ill citizens are abandoned, they're being warehoused, and living is not discussed. And she was speaking about wanting to get care in her own home, and why can't she get that? And she, you know, has had experience in nursing homes for convalescent care, and she went in there and she just had to leave because
She said she just wanted to get out. But it's interesting, Louise Byrne, because there are two bodies before the health committee next week. One is HICWA, and so presumably we'll be hearing more about nursing homes, but the other is Children's Health Ireland, which has just
another set of our most vulnerable citizens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the health committee is going to have a very, very busy week. It's next week, I think. And
can you talk us through because obviously it has evolved a little bit since the Sunday Times piece last week, and it's very much moved into the political machinations of the controversy.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, it's worth saying Sunday Times and John Mooney, and again today, John Mooney and Jennifer Bray have done wonderful work on the Children's Health Ireland scandal, as we now see it. And John first reported a fortnight ago about the use of the National Purchase Treatment Fund and how perhaps that was not being used in a proper fashion. He spoke.
This was one of the allegations raised in a report from 2021
yes, report from CHI, which had not been published, which had not been given to the Health Minister. The Health Minister, Jennifer Carol McNeill, found out about this report's existence through a media query, as did Bernard Gloucester, which is completely and utterly unacceptable. But the allegation in that was that young patients were being referred to weekend clinics funded through the National Purchase Treatment Fund rather than being seen on public waiting lists. And there were questions raised about whether those children were receiving their care in the most timely fashion, whether they should have been perhaps referred to another doctor, whether there was other children who should have perhaps been seen by the NTPF funding being overlooked, and a whole plethora of issues. And the Irish Times continued the reporting on this during the week, and they reported that the consultant involved, who has now since retired, was working these weekend clinics but had not been working his on-call hours due to health issues, during the week.
And this person has obviously stepped back. And I know, as I said at the outset, there was I think they've since retired, but there was obviously a meeting between HSE officials and Gardaí on Friday. Ronan, can I just ask you about this? Because Children's Health Ireland, I think, is the Sunday Times editorial said, it's not just any old agency. We are relying on these consultants, the clinical staff, to deliver the biggest health investment in years.
I want to respond, first of all, just briefly to that narrative that the consultant wasn't doing his on-call hours but was holding extra clinics. The first thing is that on-call can be difficult, particularly as you get older. I mean, I was up at 3 o'clock last night and half four with calls. And so it can be difficult as you get older to function the next day. And so there needs to be realisation as people get older, some of that on call can't do. And then other people do have problems. You know, they may have other heart issues where it's not appropriate to be up all night, or may have obstructive sleep apnea. So let's not make the narrative that a person didn't have a medical issue. The second thing to say is that it's not news to me that people were paid to go over and above their contractual hours to kind of to catch up on waiting lists. For example, this happened with X-ray reporting previously as well, where we had to pay people to catch up with the huge waiting list that had built up. Now, why they built up is a different issue. Now, you can argue, Sarah, and I know you're going to come in, that there's a potential conflict of interest. And there is. I'm not saying that that's the system.
But if you outsource it... Is it one created by the state? Because going back it wants these blitzes. It wants these...
Because
vast reductions
we can't, be it housing, be it healthcare, name anything, be it water infrastructure, we are not keeping pace with our population demands. And that's a broader discussion. There's been a huge explosion and we haven't been able to keep pace with it. But going back to CHI, and so I think that individual case, first of all, we should park that narrative. The second thing is that the report isn't out in the public domain. So there's a lot of whispers going on, including our own coffee rooms, as to what's happening and what's not happening. And that's not fair on individuals who may be under intense focus and stress. And they may have actually no case to answer, but be subject to this innuendo and whisper, which is not fair. But what I will say is this, is that when you bring three hospitals together, and I was part of this when Tala Hospital came together, it is always a difficult thing because the institutions
And we're not obviously
have different cultures and experiences.
Any individual,
but
this
I do think that the new chief executive, who was the chief executive for our hospital, Miss Lucy Nugent, I do think she should be given a proper chance because if anybody can pull this together,
and there's
she
a lot
can.
Of support in the papers.
Now, going back
for
to the
that.
Public concerns. It is completely unacceptable to me as a doctor and to all the medical profession that there might have been inappropriate operations done. So that's the first point to make. But that will be subject to a proper external medical review. And that's the review that needs to take. And if there is cases that need to be answered, the medical council will take them up.
Sam Tranum, in your country of origin, people get bankrupt because of medical bills. What's been your experience of the system here? And I suppose an outsider's view looking at these stories today.
My experience of the Irish healthcare system has been good. I've got two young children. I bring them to the GP. They've been admitted to hospital a couple of times through the A&E. I've had minor surgery here and worked okay. Like, I mean, every single experience was miserable, but that was because every single experience was brought on by a health problem or, a crisis. It's never going to be fun. I would never have wanted to do it, but like, what do you want, really? I got good treatment in a timely fashion. In the US, where I lived until, I don't know, I was 27 maybe, all the cost implications are, you know, the bankruptcies and everything are well known, I think, over here. I never heard of a waiting list. I don't think there was one.
In the US?
In the US. Mm. I lived in Kyrgyzstan as well for a little while, one of the former Soviet republics in Central Asia, and the healthcare system there I had a good experience with. It had much more easily accessible sort of primary care in the community. There was a clinic on my corner where I could go around. I knew the nurse for like, I would see her around at the coffee shop or whatever, and if I needed something, there was no cost. Prescriptions were almost zero.
Quite a different political order, though. Yeah. Sarah,
no, it's not. It's a democracy
as
well.
So just a few, first of all, if I could answer the question you put to Sam, I have my three children in the public health system. I was admitted to Mullingar Hospital last year as a medical emergency for what could have been a very serious condition, and I got an operation in the middle of the night, which I needed. My father was getting treated in the private healthcare system, got side effects, and ended up in Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown, where they took care of him fantastically. When you get into the public system, it really, really works. And I feel very sorry for people in the public health system, including those administrators that we give out about at the top. They're just kicked day in, day out. And actually, they are making an awful lot of people healthy every single day.
I do think you nailed it, though, sir, when you get into the public system. That's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you receive wonderful care.
So on that, so I want to talk about the waiting list. So the first thing is, with regard to the waiting list manipulation that was going on by that particular consultant in CHI. I will absolutely guarantee you that practices like that are taking place across the whole system
and
not just in CHI.
And the report hasn't been published yet, as Ronan said.
Yeah. So, but I want to give an example of good news and how particular consultants, and when they get a good ops team behind them, can really attack waiting lists when they choose to do so. So I did a column last year about Matthew Barrett, the cardiologist, and he inherited a waiting list of 1,200 from St. Vincent's North Wicklow and just slashed it, reduced the long waiters by 84% through various schemes.
And there will be many, and that is what is encouraged, that, that these blitzes are encouraged.
Yeah, but wait, but the point is he did it within the public system, not the private. You know, so not by outsourcing stuff, by getting back to GPs, by having a system where GPs can send test results directly to the consultant, stuff like that, opening up outpatient clinics in the community. And they've done this with a lot of different conditions, chronic conditions, so people get that primary care they needed so they don't go into the hospital. There is reform happening, and there's a big piece of reform that's now going to be introduced, activity-based funding. And this is where the departments will be able to see what all the hospitals and doctors are doing and any outlying behaviour by particular consultants would be spotted straight away.
Louise Byrne, just on that, just before I go to the break, because nobody is disputing that many doctors are doing and clinicians are doing absolutely fantastic work within the system. It was sort of salient this week that, you know, the usual sort of caveats about the vast majority of clinicians are doing, you know, great work wasn't really heard. And is there a risk that if we get into a row and sort of demonise clinical professionals, we are relying on them to deliver health services, including the National Children's Hospital?
I mean, absolutely. And the fear is that doctors will just go off to Australia. And I mean, we have to look at rogue practice. If there is rogue practice going on in any field, has to be called out. But it can't be a case that you tar everyone with the same brush. And I mean, as someone, I have a condition and I have been going to children's hospitals, doctors, adult hospitals my whole entire life. And the doctors there do wonderful work. But, you know, we can't punish them because they are worked to the bone. They are, you know, in not very nice conditions. I mean, I have friends who are doctors who went off to Australia to work for a couple of years. And the one thing that they said when they came back was the difference in the work-life balance. And, you know, what's to stop more people going? And how do we make our health service attractive? How do we ensure that we can keep doctors here and attract doctors from overseas? Because a lot of people don't want to hear it, but the doctors from overseas keep our health service running.
But that's why in my column, about once or twice a year, I will pick out a case of reform that is working, because they never get that acknowledgement that the reform is working.
They don't. I'm going to have to.
But our infrastructure is very poor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why did it take so long for this to come out? Since so 2021 investigation.
Well, that's another matter, but we're going to take a quick break and we might come back to it after that. You're all very welcome back. Louise Byrne, Sarah Carey, Professor Ronan Collins and Sam Tranham are here with me going through all the stuff in the papers. Ronan, I might just go to that big decision by Trinity College Dublin earlier this week to cut ties with Israeli organisations. You picked Eilish O'Hanlon's piece on this in the Sunday Independent. As an academic as well as a practitioner, how do you feel about the decision?
Well, let's leave the appalling, I think what everyone now agrees is genocide in Gaza to one side. But apart from that, academic institutions should not be in the business of censoring, particularly when it comes to fellow academics kind of researching within an institution. You know, that's akin to burning books in my mind. Academia must always allow freedom of expression, respectful debate, research, evidence. That's how peace happens, by people talking to one another. So stopping a community or, if you like, ostracising one group of people who are academics, and who, by the way, many Israeli people...
How is peace going to happen between Israelis and
Palestinians?
The problem here is, though, as well, though, and I'm not going to defend Israel, but I don't blame every Israeli for what's happening.
Or every Jew.
Oh, well, let's not conflate that.
Yeah.
I do not want to conflate that because, you know, when I... You know,
I think it's very important. We're not conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Israel.
And you cannot conflate Judaism solely with Israel. Yeah. You cannot. Yeah. But I saw many Israeli people themselves protesting about what's happening in Gaza. There are many people like former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, very vocal about what Israel is doing and that Israel is committing war crimes, even though he said himself that, you know, he's been under extreme pressure from the government. This government in Israel, not the country, this government in Israel is a bad government. I mean, who responds to a terrorist organisation like that they've responded to? I mean, I'm not excusing the atrocities committed by Hamas here. Let's not forget that and the incident. But a legitimate government cannot respond to a terrorist organisation like they are responding. Imagine if England responded to the whole of Ireland because of what the IRA did. But here's the point I wanted to make finish, is that when it comes back to academia, there cannot be censoring of students just because they're Israeli.
Having Israeli students on campus at Trinity going to bring peace in Palestine?
What?
How is having Israeli students on campus at Trinity?
How is not having them on campus going to bring peace to Palestine?
You said this is how peace happens, through academic exchange.
Peace happens by talking all the time, by having
people.
It's not
happening. There's lots of talking.
Can I just bring in Sarah Kerr? I know you're looking to get in there. The decision by Trinity was not a rash one. They put together a task force of academics, of union staff, of students. They got a former... let's not impugn the group that was put together. It was chaired by a former president of the
Mary
High Court,
Irvine.
Mary Irvine. And it met 14 times on this issue before it made a report. So it wasn't a rash decision.
But the problem is they're not publishing the report. The problem is they've said they are referring the report to the board for governance issues, yet they're implementing the report straight away. And here's the key thing. I do a lot of work around Holocaust Memorial, I work with, Jews on some of the anti-Semitism. I've done this over the years. My sister-in-law is Jewish. I was at an event in Trinity, years before the war, that David Baddiel, who was talking about his book, Jews Don't Count, and the anti-Semitism that they face. And the Jewish students in Trinity were saying before the war that they felt very lonely and very stigmatized on Canvas, because any time they say, I'm Jewish, they're asked, first of all, well, we need you to condemn the actions of the Israeli government. Okay, so Trinity ended up offering the Jews on campus a safe room because the atmosphere was so hostile on campus. And as Oliver Sears, the head of Holocaust Awareness Ireland, said, well, where is it? In the attic. So what this ban is doing, so a lot of people would support divestment of investments in companies, say particularly
including,
and settlers,
including companies on the UN blacklist.
What this is doing is saying that Erasmus students from Israeli universities can't come onto Trinity, take place in those schemes anymore. And
they're not going to continue. They've been inbound only for a number of years.
And as Eilish O'Hanlon said, citizens of no other country on earth are similarly excluded, whatever crimes their governments may have committed. And I spoke to one Jewish academic on the campus, Irish born, and she was saying this week that one thing that really upset her was that in the statement that Trinity issued, that they could have mentioned in the statement, can we please all remember this is a community, and within this community of academics, and students, we do have a right to actually respect each other's views.
Can I bring in Sam there? Because few, if any, university campuses or bodies have not been touched by the by what's happening in the Middle East. And you look to the US, where a lot of students are being raided by ICE. There's ICE raids. They're being evicted. We're seeing the reiteration in all but name of the Muslim ban. So what are your thoughts on it? Should universities, if they wish, take a stand?
I think all governments, including the Irish government, should be pulling every lever that it can to put an end to the mass murder in Gaza.
I'm specifically asking about universities, which are meant to be places of academic freedom.
I don't think they should be exempt. I don't know. I don't understand how you... Okay, well, I think, yes, that every lever, including... Israeli students from coming to Trinity,
even if they're against
banning Israeli sports people from international competition, the same way as was done, I think, during apartheid under South Africa. And I think that.
And what about Iranians?
Addition,
would you do that for the Iranians for the Chinese?
In addition to. I was about to say Russia, we should be focusing on at the moment.
Oh, so you want to ban the Russians?
I want to bring Louise Byrne in on that. I think when mass murder is going on, you should use every lever that you can to try to stop it.
I think it's worth saying that a lot of Israeli people do not support the war in Gaza. And I mean, I would fear that you are isolating Israeli people who do not support the war in Gaza. Yes. And you can't paint everyone with the same brush. And I mean, I think a lot of people, when they look at what is happening in Gaza, the idea of religion doesn't necessarily come into it. Like, I wouldn't look at
Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I wouldn't look at the war in Gaza and going, oh God, that's awful, Jewish people. I would just say, God, that's awful, the actions that are being taken. And I think in some ways, it's awful if the Jewish people in Ireland feel that they are being targeted, and we need to look beyond that. But we need to blame the people who are responsible for this.
But I'm sorry, the collective punishment that we should be stopping is the mass starvation and murder of
our embassy in Israel.
We didn't, and it remains very much open. But I'm afraid that that is it. We could certainly do another hour, if not more, on this. But coming up to 12, I do have to go to the newsroom. My thanks to Louise Byrne, political correspondent for the Irish Mirror, Sarah Carey, columnist for the Irish Independent, Professor Ronan Collins, consultant geriatrician, and Sam Tranum. Thank you very much, editor of the Dublin Inquirer.